You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 16th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, how are you guys doing? We're getting into like the full spring, summer situation. It's always nice. The wildlife is out in force. There is so much wildlife in Connecticut now.
Oh my God.
It's really something's going on. I don't know if it's just the pandemic or what it is.
It could be.
Is the weather really, really nice?
That is so weird that you say that, Steve, because I have noticed that, like, I see a lot of deer walking in the street.
Yeah.
Just in the street?
Yeah, like, just not afraid, just like walking around, like, I don't know.
I had a patient tell me, she lives in like northern Connecticut, that she saw a moose in her yard.
What?
I didn't even know we had moose in Connecticut. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, there's
moose here? Big, magnificent
beasts.
They're big
animals.
If you see one, get away from it, by the way. They're not safe to be around.
Yeah. Speaking of big animals, Liz and I were in the car yesterday. Steve, I wish you were with us. This huge bird flew in front of the car. Big. I mean, it had to have a 4-foot wingspan. I mean, to see one that close, it's been a long time. I haven't seen one that close since, you know, at a bird show. Just so impressive.
What color was it?
It had a beak, you know, and it had lots of feathers. I don't know what the hell it was.
It was beaky.
Talons.
Oh, I know what that is.
Brown. I mean, it was brown. Yeah, brown feathers. That's about all I could tell
you. Okay, so it wasn't black.
Wasn't black, no.
All right, so that eliminates a vulture. It was it like brown, like streaky brown, like mottled kind of? Not a uniform brown.
It was hawkish. Fairly, you know, memory and all. I would say more uniform than streaky.
The only other thing that really gets that big, other than like a water bird, like I'm sure if it were like a heron, you would have noticed that probably.
It's a red heron.
It was probably a red-tailed hawk. That's the biggest, otherwise.
Yeah,
biggest
I'm thinking hawk. It's more hawk-like than those other birds. Yeah.
And that means it went... Or whatever that noise is.
Yeah. The eponymous eagle noise.
Yeah, the red-tailed hawk is the sound used for movies and TV to represent every single raptor.
Yep. Yep.
That's right. It's the world scream.
It makes sense.
Birds.
It is an awesomely epic sound.
Yeah,
it is. It's great.
I had a bird encounter today too, though it was less dramatic. But
somebody flipped you off?
No, I was doing a little yard work, and I was going to trim a it's like a short evergreen tree. It's actually a Christmas tree that I planted because I bought a live one year rather than a cut one.
I did that once.
Oh, yeah, cool! And then you just planted it.
Yeah. So it's doing really,
heavy
really well.
Hell.
So, but I was going to trim it a little bit. So I'm like right up next to it, and I noticed that there's a bird sitting 12 inches from my face, right? It's like right there, right at eye level.
Whoa.
It was it's a mourning dove. So, but
oh, I like those.
Yeah, pretty. But sitting on a nest, and that bird was not moving for nothing. She was just like frozen like a statue. And normally I wouldn't deliberately get that close to a bird anyway, but it clearly was its strategy, was just to completely freeze. Although it was not well hidden. It was very, very exposed.
So that may not serve it very well in the future.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it had to make a choice.
Yeah. We have a lot of mourning doves in the area, so I'm not surprised. You guys have a lot of them in your yard. Do you have them in California, mourning doves?
I think so. I'm looking. Yeah, we've got them all over California. Yeah. They're so pretty. They like mourning to post doves. On, call them like security cameras. I always notice them on people's security cameras on their front
cams
porches.
And stuff. Oh, like rings.
Yeah, they just really like to be like in the eaves of people's houses and stuff. Mm-hmm.
It's good for so
mourning doves in the eaves. That's oxymoronic.
Hi-o.
No, but it's not that kind of mourning, Evan. It's mour.
They're sad.
It's the mourning.
Oh, now who died? Now what's the problem?
Because they make the sound that they make. It sounds like a sad call.
Does it sound like this?
No.
Like that?
Just like that.
Exactly.
I hear that regularly.
Yeah, it's good,
I wake up to that sound. No, they're also called rain doves and turtle doves. And they used to be known as
doves.
Carolina pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
They are pigeony. I mean, they must be from the same.
Yeah, they are. They're
general.
In the same group.
Yeah, yeah. They're so pretty, though.
Totally. Yeah, I have all my feeders up. So I have a hummingbird feeder, a regular birdseed feeder, a finch feeder, and a suet feeder. I have four bird feeders off my deck.
Suet?
And
keep the rest of the wildlife.
And we put out fruit.
Out
we put out fruit for the fruit eating birds.
We had a party, like just a small get together of vaccinated people at a friend's house, kind of on the west side of LA, because their kid was turning five. And so they got a bounce house and it was really fun. And they have also a lot of feeders and this really lovely hummingbird feeder that they keep a camera on. And we had left all the doors open and a hummingbird came in the house and we could not catch it to save our lives. It kept going up because that's what they do. They fly straight up. And they have this big, like, pitched roof, and it was so stressful for all of us. Everybody's standing by the doors, like, putting out the feeders and trying to, like, get it out, and we didn't want to use a net because apparently that's not good. With little tiny hummingbirds, you can harm them. Finally got it out, but it was a whole production. It was, like, probably 45 minutes of drama during this party to get this tiny hummingbird out of the house.
We occasionally get, get birds in the house.
Yeah.
If we leave the windows open, eventually a bird's going to fly through it. or sometimes they take up residence in the garage and they fly in through the garage door when we come in. But we just have to open, you have to open a window and kind of corral them in the right direction and hope they fly out, but you can't really catch them, you know.
Well, we had a bird that was hitting a sliding glass window over and over and over. Mm. We bought all those things that you buy, the outline of a bird, stickers, the random patterns, stickers. My mom put actual like fake owls by the glass, and this bird just kept bumping into the glass over and over and over. I thought maybe you know, sometimes it had some stuff in its mouth. I thought it was trying to get in to make a nest, or maybe it just saw its reflection and thought, oh look, you know, a competitor, I must defeat them. And I thought he was just trying to like bump his reflection, and I looked at him hit, it was like hitting his chest, so I thought, okay, that's better than hitting your head. And then, but it wouldn't stop no matter what we did. I said, screw it. I mean, let him do what he's going to do because nothing's working. And then like a week later, found him dead outside. It's like, whoops.
Oh.
Toast. Yeah. So I was like, we tried everything. I just don't know what else we could have done.
Steve, what do you think? The bird saw something in the house? Like, what is that?
Yeah, there's a few reasons why a bird might do that. They often like can't see the glass and they're trying to get, you know, to the room. They think that's a good place to go to find food or to nest or whatever. I think that, you know, that window that Bob was talking about, I think, right. I mean, I don't think they really were seeing their reflection as much as
Yeah. Cause some days it was like sunny, some days it was cloudy. So I'm like, I don't think it's a reflection. I think he was actually seeing inside, like, hey, that looks kind of nice in there.
They don't understand the principle of glass. So they're just trying to fly through it. Do you remember Bob?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Yeah, there was this one window that was a huge glass window, and it was, I guess, just in the wrong configuration. And like, there were some days where like 20 birds would kill themselves against that window.
Jeez.
Like, just all throughout the day, boom, there's another one, you know?
One day was, what would you call it? It was like
the bird apocalypse, yeah.
Bird apocalypse. a couple dozen birds. It's like you see blood and guts on a lot of different windows in that area. Like, oh boy, what a day.
Yeah.
I think the sun was just right. And I think they just cleaned them too, which,
I think that's a huge source of bird deaths is windows on buildings.
Yeah.
They really need to be designed, you know, to not to be a hazard for birds. All right. We have some interesting news items coming up. We're going to start with one on bad science reporting, something that we talk a lot about on the show because there's a lot of it. But this was an interesting study. So I'm going to talk about the study and we'll give a little bit of review of other studies looking at science reporting. One of the main questions is we obviously know there's a lot of horrible science reporting out there, you know, and there are news stories which will exaggerate the claims, will misrepresent the claims, will infer a causation when one was not implied by the data, will report speculative interpretations they don't necessarily go to the original paper or interview uninvolved experts. They will, in fact, often just repeat whatever the press release says. You know, we call that science by press release. But that doesn't mean that journalists are the only source of the problem. A few years ago, we talked about a study, I don't know if you guys remember this, where they looked at news stories headlines and then they looked at those that had, well, they also looked at the press release for that news item, and they looked at the article, the study itself, right? And if the press release from the institution exaggerated the claims of the study, the journalists were like four times more likely to exaggerate the claims themselves. It was like the largest predictive factor in whether or not the journalists were going to misreport the study was whether the press release did. So the press office gets a lot of blame. But of course, the press office, often they say like, well, the scientists don't respond to their inquiries, or they're too slow and they've got to, you know, keep up with the news cycle. Or sometimes they're literally just repeating what was in the abstract or the discussion of the article itself. So, you know, the one that we made the most fun of was the space dinosaurs, right? Where you had an article about the chirality of proteins on meteorites, right? Mm-hmm. And in the discussion, the author completely gratuitously says this could mean that other planets have intelligent advanced space dinosaurs, you know, like completely out of the blue, having nothing to do with the study. And of course, that's what the press office ran with, and that's what all the journalists ran with. Scientist says that there are space dinosaurs, you know.
Well, we got a good t-shirt out of it.
We did. Yes, we did. Anyway, so this is focusing on this new study is focusing on a very specific issue. So they were looking at studies of Alzheimer's disease. Now, did you know that humans are the only species that suffers from Alzheimer's disease?
That really, I didn't know that.
We're not.
You mean like we're the only ones who have the constellation of symptoms that is called Alzheimer's disease?
Yes.
Or we're the only ones who have plaques and tangles?
So
yeah, I'm thinking plaques.
There are animals that have plaques,
right?
But none that have the full pathological suite of findings that make up Alzheimer's disease, and none that have the dementia, even though obviously it'd be different to diagnose that in animals, but you could diagnose that in animals.
So we have animal models of Alzheimer's, but
we have animal models. Exactly. Oh,
okay.
So we have those animal models are convenient for doing research, but it's not Alzheimer's disease. It's as close as we can get in an animal model. But then you'd have to, any findings are tentative because it's not Alzheimer's disease. It's just something that is approximating it in some way, we think, you know. And so any findings would have to be replicated in humans before we could say it means anything. And that translation is going to be very tricky. So what they looked for was scientific studies about Alzheimer's disease in mouse models of AD. So again, it's not AD, it's a mouse model of AD. And they compared whether or not the title of the article included the fact that this was done in mice, that the study was done in mice. And then they said, how did that have any effect on whether or not the reporting about that study mentioned that it was done in mice? And unsurprisingly, it did. So for those studies where the title of the article said that it was in mice, 46.2% of the headlines also did. So that's still less than half, by the way. So even when the title of the published scientific study said, like, in mice, only half, a little bit less than half of the science reporting mentioned that it was a study in mice and not people. But if the title did not mention it, only 10% did. So it dropped from 46% to 10%.
I'm actually surprised any did, to be honest.
But that sounds about right to me, about 10% of science journalists did a good job, you know, like, but put it in context. By the way, this is a study in mice, you know.
I feel like it's because they know that if they say that, people won't read it.
Well, that's a separate question that they looked at.
Right.
So how newsworthy were these stories considered to be? So you could look at this a couple of ways. One way they looked at it was how many of the scientific studies generated at least one news story. And there was no difference. So that was the same number, whether or not the scientific study was declared that it was a mouse study in the title. But then they also looked at how many news stories they provoked. And for the ones that did declare that it was a mouse study, on average, they generated 3 news stories. And for the ones that did not, it was 3.9. So almost 4. So it was like almost a third, you know, about 30% more news stories on average about those studies that did not mention that it was in mice. And that was statistically significant. So not a huge, huge difference, but there was a difference in how many stories it generated, but not how many got at least one news reporting about it. So it was, you know, I would say it's mildly deemed to be more newsworthy if you leave out the bit about it being in mice, but not a huge effect.
Okay.
Yeah. So it does highlight a narrow aspect of science reporting, but it does, you know, it is a good reminder that a lot of the responsibility falls on scientists. So while I do not let journalists off the hook at all, it is their responsibility as journalists to do, you know, journalism, to do investigation, to say, how good is this study? How relevant is it? Are the scientists overcalling it? And, you know, let's talk to an expert who's not involved in the study and let them and ask them what, you know, what's going on here.
Yeah, that's why you always see that. You always see so-and-so who was not involved in the present study.
Yeah.
Thinks that X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, the author says this, but the rest of the scientific community, they're not so sure. And, or, you know, how do we put this into context of other scientific studies? There's, a, you know, a minority, I think, of science journalists who do that, partly because they're a minority of journalists who are reporting science or science journalists. And
true. This, a lot of them are general assignment reporters. And even science reporters, there's a big difference between if they're trying to do daily write-ups or if they're able to write features. You know, a lot of times they don't have the resources or the time to do deep reporting because that's not what they're assigned to do. They're assigned to do a write-around. And so those are all different kinds of jobs. And we as the consumers don't always know that.
And maybe even more important than whether or not the journalist is a science journalist is whether or not their editor is a science editor.
True.
Because if they were reporting to a science editor, it almost wouldn't matter as much if, you know, how would their science journalism background is. Would matter, but not, you know, there'd be an important filter in place. So now we have generalist reporters reporting to generalist editors about science stories. They don't know what's going on, so they just repeat the press release.
Yeah,
and sure. The experts wrote this, so I've got to trust it. And it's I want to give a shout out right now just to interject to I don't know if you guys were following the Pulitzers, but Ed Yong, who is an incredible science journalist, I'd say probably one of the best that we have, recently won a Pulitzer for his reporting at The Atlantic. And if you haven't read any of his big, like, long read pieces, I highly recommend them. So Ed.
No, there are some gems out there, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, obviously it's buried in, like, ridiculous reporting.
Yeah, like, we know them by name.
Yeah, exactly. I do think that because of social media, a lot of scientists have stepped up and filled the void. And I think that's a lot of what we try to do is say, okay, let's try to put this into, let's do the journalism that they didn't do, you know?
And I think you see great science report, the good science reporters come from varied backgrounds. So people who work in science journalism who, you know, really pride themselves as being science communicators or science journalists. Some of them came from J school. Some of them were scientists first, and they switched fields to become science journalists.
Or they're doing both at the same time. But what this study highlights is that scientists have to take responsibility for how their own research is reported. And I think that they need to be, when they write their abstract, when they write their discussion, when they write their headline, they have to be thinking they're not just communicating to their colleagues in the scientific community or the journal editor. They are also communicating to the public. Now, what I have seen personally from multiple angles, you know, as a science communicator, you know, as somebody who works at a university, et cetera, is that for most scientists, for most of the work that they do, they get no media attention.
Yeah.
And so they have no experience with it. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly they do get media attention and they have no idea how to handle it. They haven't been trained to handle it. And then they get bowled over in one way or another, or, you know, they think they're being cheeky, or they're, you know, they're free to speculate in their discussion, not realizing that some journalist is going to use this as plausible deniability to run with the most sensational interpretation of what they're saying.
But I think you also see a handful, and this is also generational, but you see a handful of scientists who say, I wrote the paper, I had it published, it's not my job to comment. I don't have time or energy to give you an interview. and I don't want to self-promote. And so what ends up happening is that the press office is like, bro, like, you got to work with me here.
Oh, totally.
I don't.
Totally. So, but that is generational.
That part's really
right.
hard, too. Yeah, it's very generational. And you don't see that as much with younger
universities
scientists.
Are at least paying lip service to, it is your responsibility to communicate your science to the public. That absolutely sure. is your responsibility. Yep. And that's
yeah,
now,
it's part of
especially
your job.
Especially if it's government-funded, public-funded, it's part absolutely. Of the funding. Yeah. Explain to us how you're going to communicate the results of this of your research to the public. But it's still, I feel, mostly lip service, and I don't think it has been fully internalized as this is a critical part of what we do. You know, I do think they get the ivory tower. I'm just doing the research and keeping my head down and doing the science. And it is an afterthought at best, you know, communicating it to the public. Maybe, if they get asked to do an interview, sure, they'll go out, they'll give a radio interview about their research. And they think they've done it. They've done their science communication. But they have to really be involved every step of the way. Take that call from your press office. Talk to them and make sure they get the press release right. That's the first juncture of preventing a lot of bad science reporting. And
and preventing
missed.
People from thinking that their metal keys are magnetically attaching to their skin.
Yeah. And this is why I think it's so great when you see outlets like The Conversation, where you've got scientists who published a big paper and it's starting to make the rounds, who write their own piece about their paper. And they say, this is what we did. This is why we did it. These are some of the questions we were trying to answer. And then they publish. Mm-hmm. I think it's really cool that we're starting to see more and more companion pieces, and we're starting to see more and more blog posts that accompany the sort of, as we know, esoteric, sometimes kind of wonky, kind of jargony laden journal articles. Let's have a piece that's written for public consumption that accompanies that. How great is that?
It's by the scientists themselves.
By the scientists themselves, yeah. We're starting to see that happening more and more.
Yeah, I think slowly it's moving in the right direction. I think is, you know, at the again, I've been doing this at a university for 20 years, and I could see people's reaction to me shifting over those 20 years. Like 20 years ago, you know, I think most of my colleagues were baffled at the whole like skepticism thing. And
if not, maybe even annoyed.
Yeah, totally. It was like mostly like a curiosity. Occasionally somebody would get it and be like, oh yeah, I'm glad you're out there doing that. And now that I think part of it is that not only that, you know, we've gotten out there more, it's also like in the last couple of years, especially I've had people like, maybe I haven't seen them in a while. They go, how are you doing? It's like, oh, what you're doing is so important now.
Yes.
They see it.
Oh my
it's
God.
Like, oh my God. Like now they realize how dangerous pseudoscience is.
Yeah.
And you know, I do think that in a way that, that realization is out there more now, you know?
Gosh, how could it not be?
Too late. Though,
you know,
it is.
Like, right. Yeah. Where were they in 2005?
Exactly. Not the way I want to be proven correct, you know, that all of our worst fears are realized. All right, but we'll keep pushing forward. Jay.
Yeah.
So should we focus our efforts more on preventing climate change or protecting species?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Exactly.
Sure.
Right now, right, like Steve said, we have two global issues that are actually making each other worse. They are, you know, married or joined together in one way or another. So we, of course, have global warming. That's pushing temperatures up around the globe. And we also have what? Biodiversity declining. You know, you could read the news every week and you can find an article about some animal that, you know, some species that is suffering because of global warming or, you know, diminishing, you know, environment for them to live. So people have been trying to deal with these two issues individually. And recently a new report has come out where 50 scientists agreed that these two problems both have significant impact on each other, and that we, you know, the community at large around the globe should work on solving them together, meaning one action can help influence both issues positively. So the report is a collaboration between the United Nations Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. I like the second one a lot better.
The IPCC, right?
IPCC.
The IPCC, that's the one that's been putting out all the, you know, the reports about climate change. You know, like that's been the focal point for years of the consensus opinion on climate change.
Well, I meant I liked it better, Steve, because it's just shorter. It's easy to say, you know. That's why we come up with things like the IPCC, because you don't want to say all this stuff. So anyway, the paper hopes to provide some form of guidance for those who are fashioning solutions for either climate change or biodiversity and how to try and solve both issues at the same time, right? Because why not? You know, it's two birds with one stone, and they are very smart in writing this paper because it's going to provide some really awesome information for people who are trying to do this. So experts believe that this report will indeed have significant influence on policymakers inside of government and conservation groups, and also have some influence on corporations, right? All three of these entities are actually very important to these primary two issues that I mentioned. So a perfect example of this is taking an area that used to be a forest, but you know, has been significantly logged, say, and turn it into a national park. Now, right out of the gate, you know, does that rub you the wrong way? Do you like that idea? Do you like, you know, taking a heavily forested area and turning it into a park? What would you want them to do with that land? Well, here's what they think. They think the park would actually be a very good thing to do. One, because it would grow trees back naturally, which would sequester carbon, right? That's a great thing. But it would also provide a new habitat for animals. Now, you're going to say, yeah, but we lost the habitat. And I'm agreeing with you. We did. But what do we do with that land afterwards? This is the question. And how do we help multiple issues at the same time? So I mentioned that there would be sequestration of carbon. And I also mentioned that if they let the forest come back naturally, that it would be a great habitat for animals to come back to. Now, if the forest grows back on its own, it would be more resilient because it would be more what? It would be more biodiverse. And this is really important. This is called a nature-based solution. It's not uncommon for companies and government programs to go in there and just plant all of the same tree or plant. And this is not a good idea. You know, they'll go to a deforested area and they'll be like, we're going to put maple trees here. This is not the right way to do it. Now, this makes the area much more susceptible to disease or some other type of catastrophe. And these things happen. So if trees and plants are diverse, then if some trees die off because of climate change, you know, and others might be more resilient to the heat, so then some of the plants will survive. That means the forest will survive. So the biodiversity is really important. Monocultures can also be significantly affected by a group of insects, right? So let's say that because of global warming, I don't know, cicadas go apeshit and they are, you know, expanding their numbers dramatically. And those cicadas like to eat a certain type of tree, and that tree is this forest. That's bad. And you'll notice if you go into the woods, you will notice that there is a really nice mix of trees. Usually there is a very, you know, I wouldn't say even, but there is a mix of trees and plant life that's there. That's what you want to see. The ultimate goal here is to have a forest hold on to its sequestered carbon and also maintain its ability to provide a home for animals. So as an example, cutting down forests or draining wetlands not only removes that land's ability to sequester carbon, but it also destroys the species that live there. So peat, as an example, you know, peat moss, right? Peat moss is actually a great sequester. It's a great sequesterer of carbon. It's a great way to put carbon. Yes, peat moss. And peat moss.
It's huge, and it's horrible when people harvest it.
Yeah, and peat moss is still heavily harvested, Kara. Yeah. It's a great energy source.
Farms. Don't they have peat moss farms?
Yes, absolutely.
It's all over Scotland. It's being like taken out.
What about
cape
moss?
Chunks.
But it's still, think about this. Peat moss, it sounds like an old world thing. It's still relevant to a lot of people. And this is, you know, we have to change our fuel sources. Of course, you know, we don't even have time to get into that, but. Right. So getting back to peat moss, when a slash and burn method is used, an enormous amount of greenhouse gases are released into the atmosphere. Because, man, when you burn peat moss, it is spilling greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We don't want to use that as fuel anymore. So being able to identify what ecosystems are highly effective is also important. So as an example, coastal mangrove forests have a significant number of benefits. These forests can sequester 4 times the amount of carbon than a rainforest. Right? A mangrove. If you look up a picture of a mangrove, you would not think that it could do that, but it does. They also act as a storm surge barrier, which is very important, and they also house a large different number of species. So mangroves are one of those examples where we shouldn't touch them, and if we do, we should try to repopulate it and bring them back if it's possible. Planting trees in cities is another example. So during the city, I'm sorry, during the day, cities absorb a ton of energy from the sun. All that pavement and all the stone that a city has exposed open air, they just soak up the heat of the sun. And if you've ever lived in a city, you know this. I mean, at night, it could be super hot in a city,
oh, yeah.
even if the temperature's around, right, Ev? You know,
sure.
the temperatures around could be cool, but man, if you're near the pavement, forget it. It's really hot. But when night comes, that energy is slowly released back out into the air. And this is actually very bad for the environment. Now, planting trees in cities provides shade during the day, which cools the city. Right out of the gate, that tree is soaking up sunlight, and it's converting that sunlight, and it's not being stored in the tree. It's being stored in the ground. The tree is using the energy from the sun in that spot. Now, those same trees also provide places for birds to live. Now, this naturally makes Steve happy, and that's also good for global warming. Nothing? Okay. and as a final bonus, giving humans access to trees and parks is excellent for what, Kara?
Mental health.
Exactly. Mental health, yes. Exactly. You are so on it, Kara. And that's why I keep telling Steve, like, we got to keep her. She's good. Don't talk to me about anything about Kara. All right. So Steve's like, stop bringing me into this. So it's important to note that the report isn't saying that people should be moved off of land and let nature do as it will, right? That's not realistic. The paper clearly states that there should be a balance between protecting the land and the well-being of the people who live on or near it. Good. That's great. I'm really happy that they didn't do the unrealistic thing of saying, hey, we've got to stop, you know, having people live in these places. Like, that's not going to happen. The paper also states that these nature-based solutions are not all that is needed to slow down the stop of climate change. This is just one piece in the puzzle. The first and most important step is that humanity has to significantly reduce its carbon footprint. When are we going to do this? You know, like, what's the slowdown here? Nature can only do so much to help against the incessant and enormous magnitude of greenhouse gases being released. It's, you know, guys, I know this, you know, we keep beating the same old drum. We have to. It's our job to do it. It's our job as critical thinkers and as people who really understand the science. We need to keep saying this over and over and over again. I'm telling you, there are people, experts that read this paper that said, you know what? This is fantastic information. It's going to be really helpful and it's going to push the ball forward.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a huge task. It's not as if we don't know what we need to do. You know, that's the thing.
Oh, yeah. We just need the will.
Yeah. Yep. It's all about political will at this point.
And de Monet, you know?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I there's been several now, like, economic evaluations, just by economists looking at the cost versus benefit. And, like, the most expensive path is to do nothing. The cost of climate change is going to be orders of magnitude greater than the cost of mitigating it.
Can't ignore it.
But like all governments, not all, but most governments and most politicians, like, are really bad at the marshmallow test. They're like, I just want this marshmallow now.
Yeah, I know, right? You know? It's like this election cycle.
Yeah. All right, Kara, tell us about COVID pseudoscience in Brazil.
Yeah, speaking about politicizing science, let's talk a little bit about Brazil. So there is an article in Undark right now, and it was published by, I'm going to butcher their names, and I'm so sorry, Kiratiana Freelon and Shanna Hanbury. I think it's just important to give them a shout out because they're both based in Brazil. Shanna Hanbury is a social scientist, and she's written for, you know, all these different outlets. And Kiratiana, she's an independent journalist out of Rio. And they co-wrote this article that I think is a really, really good summary of what is going on with regards to COVID and the, quote, mitigation strategy in the country. It kind of starts talking about the city of Manaus, and it's an Amazonian city. And in January 2021, in the Amazonian city of Manaus, COVID-19 patients ran out of oxygen. Within the first 2 months just of this year, 4,430 people alone died in this city. The Ministry of Health, they knew oxygen supply was dangerously low. You guys may remember some of the coverage about this. But instead of securing the necessary treatment, they continued to push a pseudoscientific cocktail onto Brazil citizens. That cocktail is called, I looked up how to pronounce this, Tratamento Precoce. And it's a vague combination of drugs that's touted by none other than Bolsonaro and others within the right-wing government. It translates into literally, the translation is early treatment. But the problem is, it doesn't work. It's not a treatment. Trattamento precoce is, or precoce is made up of some combination of ivermectin, which is an antiparasitic that is used to treat lice and roundworm infections. Hydroxychloroquine, which we've discussed a lot on the show. That's an anti-malarial drug, but it can also be used to treat lupus. Azithromycin, so that's the standard Z-Pack that many of us have taken, an antibiotic, and a bunch of vitamins, anticoagulant medications, and painkillers thrown in for good measure. It is not known to help COVID-19 infection in any way. It is known to cause tachycardia and liver toxicity. At this point, Brazil's on track to reach about 500,000 COVID deaths very soon. I think they're at 491,000. And even though the country is starting to warm up to a vaccination campaign, only about 14% of the population is currently vaccinated. Last year, the country refused multiple offers from drug manufacturers like Pfizer. Pfizer specifically tried to sell vaccines to Brazil at half price of what they charged the U.S. and European countries. But Brazil rejected those offers. The only reason that the country has access to any vaccine currently is because the governor of Sao Paulo state made a deal with the Chinese vaccine manufacturer to secure some doses. And remember, Trattamento Precoce is promoted not only by the Brazilian president, but also by its health ministry. It's also promoted by many providers in the country. There's even a group within the country called Doctors for Life, who recently published a manifesto in 70 of Brazil's top newspapers with nearly 5,000 physician signatures advocating for hydroxychloroquine and other unproven treatments. There are currently some investigations, I think on April 27th, the Brazilian Senate opened a formal investigation into how the government has handled the pandemic, but you still are seeing people from within the government who are pushing and touting these treatments, these early treatments, as they call them. So you have epidemiologists and whistleblowers from within the government saying, why are we still doing this? If these drugs work, then why are we seeing that the situation is getting worse and worse in this country? Yet you have people holding on for dear life. And I think that, like, here's a great example from Mayra Pinheiro, who is the main official behind Manaus's January early treatment campaign. She's actually the Ministry of Health Secretary of Labor Management and Health Education. And she said, quote, in a pandemic situation, ideal scientific evidence on pharmacological and non-pharmacological measures can take time, which has a high cost in human lives. It is necessary to not interfere in the autonomy of patients and their doctors in promoting the solution, even if it's a temporary one. So she is using sophisticated language to basically promote a scapegoat and to say, we don't have complete evidence. So if we don't have complete evidence, we don't need any evidence. And we can just stick with unproven efforts. And it's really, really dangerous that individuals within the government continue to tout this. Your everyday citizen does not know the difference. Your everyday citizen is hearing mixed messages. Many of them aren't even hearing mixed messages. They're only hearing one message. And that's the government. That's the message from their government saying, this is what you should do to prevent infection. Although we know for a fact, we know from so many studies that this does not prevent infection. And there's even a study that was recently published. Unfortunately, it was published as a non-peer-reviewed preprint at this point, where 3,046 residents of Manaus, the city within the in the Amazon region that I mentioned, were studied longitudinally. These are individuals from the Federal University of Amazonas and from an organization called Fiocruz Amazonia. And what they did is they followed these patients over several months and they asked them a bunch of questions and they looked at whether or not they contracted it. And they found that, unfortunately, doing this pre-treatment made the people feel more protected and therefore they lowered their guard. So they were less likely to do things like wear masks. They were less likely to do things like social distance, and they were more likely to act in the world as if they were protected from this disease, but they were not. This is very, very dangerous. And this is something that can't be ignored. It can't be ignored by the rest of the world because it's a trend that I think here in the US we understand intimately because we see a lot of parallels between what happened in our country during the previous administration and what's happening during Bolsonaro's administration. We're seeing it across social media, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook. These are places where Bolsonaro, where different influencers, even physicians are hawking these unproven cocktails. We're seeing that the sales of these cocktails or these specific drugs are skyrocketing, sometimes 100, 500% higher than they were in previous years. And I think the important thing to remember here is that the voices that many of the everyday citizens are hearing seem reliable. They seem evidence-based. And there are active campaigns on social media. They've previously been called by other journalists digital militias. So these are like pro-Bolsonaro online communities where they're pushing out this rhetoric. They're pushing out this pseudoscience. They're hearing it from within their government. They're hearing it on apps that are rolling out from the health ministry. And it's very difficult to, I don't even want to say blame, but it's difficult not to empathize with the everyday Brazilian citizen who's being fed this rhetoric. And it's heartbreaking to think about the fact that so many lives didn't have to be lost if health officials were willing to look at the evidence and not let politics, propaganda, and their agenda get in the way. This is a perfect example of what happens when science-based public health efforts are covered up, are minimized by governmental and political agendas. And it's really rough. I'm glad we got out of it here in our country. I'm glad we're starting to see the light because unfortunately it's still actively happening in Brazil.
I don't understand this one though. Like why would political orientation make you choose some treatments over others?
Right.
Right. What's the goal here? You know, the only thing I could say is I think that I don't think it's necessarily right versus left. It's more like an authoritarian government. They're used to creating their own reality.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely authoritarian.
This works because I say it does. And this is working and everything is great and problem solved.
It's also this inability to be wrong. So early on, there were open-ended questions. There still are open-ended questions about, for example, ivermectin. Like there's still active trials going on with ivermectin, but it's not looking good. And we know at this point that hydroxychloroquine is not good. And we know that antibiotics don't work. We know that these vitamins don't work.
Vaccine works.
But yeah, exactly. But early on, we were like, maybe this is an appropriate treatment. And the problem is with when you have an authoritarian worldview, you cannot be fallible in front of your citizens.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big reason that Bolsonaro doubles down and that his government doubles down. I also think it's easier and cheaper to keep pushing this thing that doesn't work than to actually shell out the money for the real treatment.
Even though they're getting it offered at half price.
Even when offered at half price. Yeah, it's oh God, it's so heartbreaking. Yeah. And you know, it is a little bit easier to understand though the mindset of the individual living in Brazil, trying to hold on to hope, trying to do something because doing something feels better than doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's so much easier for me to empathize with why people decide to do this tratamento precoce, because that's what everybody says they should be doing. And it's like $30 to buy this cocktail and you can get it at the local pharmacy. It's readily available.
It's effectively a one choice system.
Totally. Exactly. It's like either do this or do nothing. And of course some of the quotes in the article, I mean, they're beautiful and heartbreaking because they're literally like, I know it probably doesn't work. Something like 2/3 of doctors in the country, when asked in survey, said we don't think it actually works. Mm-hmm. But they still are prescribing it or recommending it because it's the only option they have. And so now at least we're starting to see a push towards vaccination and maybe a light at the end of the tunnel, but it's going to be a lot of work.
That's a lot of catch up they have.
Yep, for that vaccine to overcome the comfortable rhetoric that a lot of people have gotten so familiar with.
Yeah, they're 6 months behind the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob, tell us about these new night vision goggles. How cool are they?
They seem pretty damn cool, potentially. So this is a potential breakthrough in night vision, which was recently published using Meta Surfaces that could one day create not night vision goggles, but night vision glasses. I mean, really small, really small footprint. Imagine just like glasses. That's kind of what they're talking about. So this was this new tech's been developed, or this little breakthrough has been developed by an international team of researchers from TMOS, ANU, Nottingham Trent University, UNSW, and European partners. And this was published in Advanced Photonics. Do you guys remember when you first saw night vision when you were a kid? I'm trying to remember exactly where we saw it. But
well, it was
like, I feel like in a movie or something.
Yeah,
right. It's in a movie, but it was like, holy crap, how cool is that? And I remember wanting it so badly, almost as much as a jetpack, but not as much as a jetpack, because, you know, jetpacks are jetpacks.
Jetpacks.
But still, it was just so cool. And I remember that I actually bought a pair like 15 years ago. And I finally had a chance to do it. It's really, really cool. So now modern types of night vision have been around since the 60s. I think that's when the modern conception of these night vision devices have been around. It's since mid-60s, I believe. And they've come a long way since then. Now, there's two types, though, two primary types. You've got the image enhancement in low light as opposed to the pure thermal imagers. So I'm not going to really be talking about thermal imagers. I'm more about image enhancement in low light. So in terms of that, you got two kinds that you could buy from Amazon like right now. One is the traditional, like when you think of it in the movies, this is what these bulky things that they wear, and those are optoelectronic image enhancers. And they've got three main layers to them. You got the photocathode, and that essentially takes the light that's coming in, the dim visible light and the infrared light, and it converts it to electrons. Bam, photons to electrons. That's the first part. The second part's got this microchannel plate, and that essentially just multiplies the electrons thousands of times, like 3,000 times the amount of electrons. And then the final piece is that all those electrons hit a phosphor screen, which lights up typically in those iconic green colors that they always, they almost invariably use for those night vision goggles in on TV and in movies. Now, color images would be nice, but the conversion of the photons to the electrons essentially just strips away the color information. So it's just, you're kind of, you know, it's like the information is just not there. Now, the other type of image enhancing tech, that's a digital image enhancement. And this is a different beast. In this case, the photons are converted to a digital signal by a CMOS imaging sensor. I'm sure you've heard about that. It stands for Digital Complementary Metal Oxide Semiconductor. Digital cameras have these. Steve, your camera has a CMOS sensor in it, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Not to be confused.
How was it in low light?
I have a pretty decent Nikon camera. It's excellent in low light. But, you know, even sometimes, like some of the newer phone cameras, I think partly because of software, do really well in low light.
Oh, yeah. The tech is just going crazy. And for this type of image enhancement, this is really improving. It used to be like far inferior to the optoelectronic enhancement, but this has really been, really come along over the years. And the larger the CMOS, the better. The image is enhanced electronically, and then it's magnified, and it just made available on your LCD display. So obviously, the bigger the CMOS, the better. Some of them are so good that you can create 1080p video from these low light images. Really amazing stuff. They're so much better. It's just trying to think, you know, what are they going to be like? They may be the go-to night vision technology, regardless of anything else in the near future. But all of these systems are really fantastic. I mean, with the goggles or the scopes, you could see people, animals, even meatballs 1,000 yards away on a dark night.
A thousand yards away.
Yeah, Jay's got an innate sense.
Jay can sniff it.
But as good as they are, they still have many drawbacks, especially for the commercially available units. The military, I'm sure, has got the best stuff, and probably stuff that there's no way you could even buy commercially at this point. But mostly the commercial stuff, they're very bulky. They're heavy. Some people actually have neck injuries. If they have a job where they need to wear them a lot, they actually have neck injuries from it. And the infrared is low energy light, right? So some imagers need low temperatures or even cryogenic cooling in order to work optimally. And that just adds to the bulk and the weight. And they also generally just block visible light, right? So your normal vision is impaired. Now, you could be looking at an external monitor to see what the night vision is seeing. But if you're on the move and you need night vision on the move, then you're not going to be looking at an external monitor and your regular vision is going to be impaired. So now this latest research, though, has been working on a completely different type of infrared image enhancement technology. This is, I guess you could say, a third type. And this is all optical. There's no intermediary electrical steps. The infrared is directly converted to visible light. Now, this isn't brand new. I mean, this is something that's been done. It's been theorized and they tested this. And this is a thing years ago. I'm not sure how it was hard to find out exactly when this was discovered and initially tested, but it's called some frequency generation. It's an optical process. And this uses nonlinear crystals. Now, nonlinear crystals, they do very weird things to light that regular crystals cannot. Like, for example, having photons actually interact with one another. Typically, photons don't interact. They just boom, go right through each other. But in nonlinear crystals, they can interact. And they could also have their frequency altered, which you cannot do in linear crystals. But they've never used that technology for night vision, though, because the crystals were heavy and expensive. And they also worked only in a very narrow frequency range. So they were just a non-starter. Until metasurfaces and metamaterials came in. So metasurfaces, metamaterials, these are micro or nano-engineered composites. They do amazing things like manipulate light based solely on their surface structures and not their chemical properties. Amazing. We've talked about it many times. You're going to be hearing about metamaterials for decades. For the rest of your life, you're going to be hearing about these and the new amazing things that they're doing with them. So these researchers created these uber thin metasurfaces to do this some frequency generation, that optical process. They did it, but they use what they call this up conversion IR imaging. That's kind of like the new bit. So instead of using the big crystals, what they have in the metasurfaces embedded are these nano antennas. These are super tiny, about hundreds of times thinner than a human hair. Hundreds of times thinner than a human hair. And they resonate with the desired frequency of light. If you make those nano antennas right perfectly, then they can resonate with any frequency of light or many different frequencies of light that you want. So they made them interact with the infrared light. And so to imagine how this works, imagine it's nighttime and the invisible infrared and the dim visible light from a person enters, reflected off a person, whatever. It enters the metasurface material and it interacts with an onboard laser light within the nonlinear metamaterial, right? So you got the light, you got the infrared light, you've got the laser light. Those two photons, say, are interacting within the nonlinear metamaterial. That's what you need. That's the critical part right there. And when that happens, then you have a higher frequency visible light come out that matches the infrared, but now it's visible and you could see it. So the photon interaction creates the amplified visible light that you can see that you otherwise would never have seen at night. So essentially, infrared goes in, visible light comes out. So let's see, I got a quote from, listen to this name, Dragomir Neshev. Dragomir, what a great first name. Director of the ARC Center for Excellence and the ANU Professor of Physics. He said, this is the first time anywhere in the world that infrared light has been successfully transformed into visible images in an ultra-thin screen. So looking to the future, in their paper, the researchers say, our results can benefit the future development of compact night vision instruments and sensor devices. Notably, the metasurface imaging devices can be ultra-thin and ultra-compact, fabricated on flexible substrates, and fully transparent. So when I first was reading this, I thought that the news item was exaggerating it. But I found that in the paper. And so what he's saying here is that they potentially could create a thin, clear material, kind of like, imagine like a clear scotch tape. That's not quite as sticky, right? Clear scotch tape. You put them on glasses and the glasses have also a built-in low power laser because that's required, right? To interact with the infrared. And then you will have, that would allow normal vision and night vision in one lightweight package. You could see in the dark with these regular glasses on your head. Jay, how much do your glasses weigh? How uncomfortable are they? Right? They're probably, you barely notice them most of the time. So that's kind of the direction they're pointing at. So what's left to do with this stuff? I think there's probably a lot of stuff left that they have to do. This was very successful, but remember, this was still just a proof of concept experiment. That's it. They didn't make these glasses. They proved that this concept works. So in their paper, it's going through their paper, man, that was dense stuff. Jeez. So they're talking about needing to enhance the conversion efficiency. I think that's because it has low transmissivity. So there's not a lot of light coming through, not enough to make it really, really viable. They also talk about using some machine learning techniques, to increase optimization. So it's definitely not a done deal at all. They could potentially, you know, be too dim to use in many different instances. But if this works, I mean, they could potentially create night vision glasses that are just so lightweight that you wouldn't even notice that they're there. I mean, you could potentially wear them all the time with your regular glasses, potentially. So a couple things I'm curious about, though. The digital image enhancement technology, you know, with the CMOS sensor, I mean, that just keeps improving so much, like many things in electronics do. I wonder how good that's going to get. You know, perhaps they're going to make that small enough and cheap enough that, you know, it's not worth it to pay more for the night goggles based on the meta materials. I don't know. Hard to say. But trying to think of, you know, how that would change things. Imagine you have glasses that are night vision. I mean, would you wear them all the time? Would you wear them around your house and just keep the lights off most of the time to save energy? Cause right. I mean, what would be different about where you could see where darkness would be nothing? You wouldn't need a flashlight. You know how your damn flashlight just drains the crap out of your battery. Imagine you could just, the darkness is really not a big deal in terms of navigating or seeing around because you have these tiny lightweight glasses on your head. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how that would change things if we ever see that level of improvement, and the jury is still out.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about these metamaterials. I mean, I do still think it's one of those things where, like, in 20, 30 years, we're really going to start seeing applications.
Oh, God, man.
You know, like tiny, teeny tiny lenses capable of extreme zoom, you know. Although right now they're limited in terms of wavelengths and it's not like a fully functional camera lens. But if they can, you know, get it to the point where it can deal with the full range of visible light, you could be looking at a camera in a cell phone that can have, you know, 1,000 zoom on it, you know.
I know. Imagine that. And it's, Steve, it's so versatile. It's not just, you know, manipulating light. How about manipulating seismic waves? You put this around your building and seismic waves would just be redirected away from your building. So you barely experience any shaking at all. I mean, that kind of stuff. I mean, you could do that. You could kind of, that's kind of the, one of the, you know, the large scale applications of metamaterials. I mean, it's all over the place. There's so many different things you can do with it.
Okay, Evan, I understand somebody had to go to the hospital because of a homeopathic overdose. How is that possible?
What?
Exactly.
How do you do that?
How do you do that?
I can tell you.
Talk about headlines catching your attention. I mean, all right, homeopathy, it's a belief system, right? Homeopaths believe that an active ingredient diluted down to nothing is medicine. And how is that possible? Well, through the careful dilution process that only a trained homeopath can perform, the water magically retains the memory of the original active ingredient. That sounds scientific, right? This is the 21st century, right? No one believes in that anymore. Don't think that. they believe it, and boy, do they. So I read this news item in Forbes, but of course it's been on other news sites. They all carried the story as well. This was earlier in June. A man in Germany was hospitalized after overdosing on a homeopathic remedy. Uh-oh, that doesn't sound good. But it does remind me of the numerous times that James Randi would swallow an entire box of homeopathic medication in a deliberate attempt to overdose. However, there's no active ingredient in there, so it's rather difficult, nay, impossible, to overdose in the technical sense on a homeopathic remedy. But this particular fellow, 53-year-old man in Germany, don't have his name, he became seriously ill after taking it and required hospital treatment after ingesting the remedy, which was incorrectly made. Yep, that'll do it every time, right? So it's reported that the man initially was not feeling well. So he went to his homeopath, bought a concoction that was crafted, local homeopath who made it up himself, got home, the man took it, 30 drops of the remedy. He took after dinner one night. Who knows if that's what he was supposed to do or not, but doesn't matter. And about 10 minutes later, he started to develop a range of symptoms, including confusion, dizziness, visual impairment, loss of speech, and the ability to walk or stand.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so not exactly minor side effects there. They rushed him to the hospital, and they tested him. They, like, what the heck could have done this? So they ruled out you know, they tested for the usual stuff, opiates, tranquilizers, legal drugs, and everything came back negative. There was no alcohol, no cannabis, nothing like that. The patient eventually got it around to telling someone that, oh, I did take this homeopathic tincture. And here it is. Yes, tincture. And he turned it over to the doctors and they analyzed it. And the tests revealed that it contained a concentration of around 3 milligrams per milliliter of atropine sulfate.
Mm.
Yeah. So
that's not good.
No, that's not good at all. They use it to dilate people's eyes during eye examination. So you're drinking eye medicine.
No, but it also, atropine will, you know, it's sympathetic, so it could speed up your heart.
Yeah.
You give your heart attack, you overdose on it.
Yeah, it's a it's like a nerve blocker.
And sure enough, the doctors tested his blood for it, and it was, well, high concentrations of it. Apparently 600 times the amount that I suppose the human body can normally tolerate.
Mm.
Yeah, not good. Wow. They say his ingestion of this stuff is just a few drops of it in its eye drop formulation can cause toxicity. What's it called? Anticholinergic toxicity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Blockade of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's bad. Very bad, Steve. I don't know if you've ever – have you ever seen cases of that or
– Oh, yeah. I mean, because a lot of drugs have anticholinergic effects and – in fact, you know, we use them, obviously, and...
Intentionally.
Yeah, intentionally. And sometimes, mm-hmm. Your patients can take too much or whatever. So that's something that is frequently something that we have to deal with.
But you can understand why a homeopath would start with something like this, because it is dangerous, you know, practically.
But why was there any measurable amount in the homeopathic medication?
Right. That's the whole point, is that they're supposed to dilute it down to nothing.
Also, isn't it cheaper to make homeopathic meds with just like nothing? Just like sugar?
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't get it. Why would they put a drug in it?
Who knows? They screwed up royally. You'd have to ask that individual.
Hey, there's actual stuff in my nothing. What's going on?
Yeah. It's like,
oh, I didn't grab the water jar. I grabbed I grabbed the other stuff.
You forget to dilute it? I mean, what's going on?
My mistake.
Well, that's what, you know, we because, you know, there's a common stunt where you could do like a homeopathic overdose to show that there's nothing in it.
Yeah, and
we
don't
counsel
do that.
People. Yeah, unless don't you make do it. That with homeopathic products that you are not familiar
not
with because
right.
they might actually contain stuff. Some of them have actual active amounts of ingredients in them.
You
can't trust that they were produced properly, if they're not contaminated, or they're not, you know, cutting it with something like a stimulant, like in order to have an actual physiological effect, you know, to convince people that it's real.
Yeah, you have to be super careful about it.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. What was that? Any guesses, guys?
A motor turning something?
Insects?
A blender or something.
All right, I got a guess from Shane Hillier, and he said, hello again. This sounds to me like fabric flapping in about 145-mile-per-hour wind inside of a wind tunnel. That's very specific. That is not correct, although I can hear what you're saying. I get why you said that. I have a guess here by Marsh Wildman. He's wild! He says, hi, Bob and everyone. This week's noisy sounds like something I'm all too familiar with, a bearing whose lubricant has long since worn away and is well on its way to self-destruction. Love the show, Marsh. I've never heard a bearing about to go nuclear, but I'm sure that it does make a crazy noise like that, but that is not correct. I got another guest here from Mike Buckley. Mike said, hi, Jay. Thanks for a great show. My gut tells me that it sounds like a cash counting sorting machine. It sounds like the bills flapping as they're being counted. Mm. That's interesting. That's actually what I would consider to be probably the closest guess this week, because no one won this week. But let me give you another guess here. This one is from Jason S. And he says, hi, Jay, Bob, Evan, Kara, Mike, Steve. this week's noisy sounds just like a key cutting machine, probably one of the automated ones that have appeared in hardware stores in the last few years. Yeah, I mean, sure, I could see a key cutting machine. They have a little bit more of a high, shrilly noise. But what was this? Hold on, one more guess, guys.
Okay.
And then we have Adam Hepburn, who wrote in and said that he played his Noisy for his 4-year-old daughter, Olivia, and she said it sounds like water. So they're guessing that it's a high-pressure water-cutting machine. A lot of people thought this was a water-based sound. Indeed, it is not. This is, and I'm really surprised nobody guessed it, this is a card punch reader, like old computer style, 80 columns of cards, right. So this thing is sorting cards. And this was essentially like the way that they stored data, right? This was just a database written on punch cards. So these punch card machines, you know, they didn't operate the way that a computer does. Like you would have to load the computer with the data that's on the punch cards, and then they would have to be resorted and put back into the correct order and in direct, you know, in the correct columns and everything. So it was very time consuming, but you know, again, it was the origin of modern computers. So we have to show them some respect. So I do. And this original Noisy was sent in by a listener named Mark Chelander. So nobody guessed it. And I'm surprised because I know that we have a lot of people that probably worked with these machines that listen to the show. All right, guys, I have a new Noisy for you this week. And this Noisy was sent in by a listener named Randy Wilson. What is that? Be specific. If you have any idea, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And also, if you heard something really cool, don't be afraid to send it in. I might just use it. So, Steve,
mm-hmm.
I have a few announcements again. Now, there's a list of things. Everybody knows that we have a ton of shows coming up. We're going to be at Dragon Con. We're doing an extravaganza during Dragon Con. We have a private show at Dragon Con. We have two private shows in Denver, and we have an extravaganza in Denver, and this is going in, that's going to happen in mid-November, right before Thanksgiving. If you want the details of these shows, go to theskepticsguide.org/events. You can see all the data there that you want. We really encourage people that are in the Atlanta area to come see us do the extravaganza. It's going to be a smaller audience show, which means it's going to be more intimate, and we will be making much more eye contact with the audience because we'll be able to see you a lot better. It's going to be a ton of fun, and join us at the extravaganza that will be in Atlanta during DragonCon. A couple more things, Steve. You know, just a little conference called Nexus that we've been doing for, 14 years now? This conference has been going on for a long time. We have a ton of experience, and this year, man, we have an incredible virtual conference for you. We will also be running another game show at Nexus that's brand new. And I can't say any details about it right now because we haven't fully named it yet, although we know exactly what it is. We just are trying to brand it the correct way. But either way, two game shows, 9 speakers, tons of other content. Please join us. Go to necss.org. Sign up today. Call your mom. Call your dad. Make sure that they go because science is for everyone. Right, Kara?
It's true.
And then we have one more thing that we'd like you to do, and this goes out to literally anybody. If you have an interesting or heartwarming or any kind of memory about James Randi, we want to make a collection of videos about Randi, and we'd like to play them at the conference. What I'm going to be doing is like just editing them down and giving everyone a few seconds to talk about something about Randi. You know, keep it as brief as you can, but tell your story, and you can email those videos to us at info@theskepticsguide.org and just, you know, put in the subject Randi and that'll get to me and I will know, and we will, you know, make a collection of these and we'll put them up on the conference so we can remember Randi. You know, we lost Randi during the pandemic and it's very important to us that we mention Randi at the conference and that we, you know, remember him and be able to talk about him positively because the man lived an amazing, respected life.
Absolutely. All right, thanks, Jay. You guys want to do a name that logical fallacy?
Yes.
Wow. Sure.
This one comes from Michael, and Michael writes, I'm a longtime regular listener and love hearing the program while I'm out for my weekend jog. I have a question regarding what I think is a logical fallacy, but I cannot put my finger on what fallacy it falls under. Recently, I was in a discussion where someone claimed that intelligent life is the intended outcome of evolution And when asked how he knew that it was the intended outcome, his reply was because evolution has produced intelligent life. Obviously, one flaw in his argument is in assuming intent to a process when intent has not been proven. But what struck me was the argument that the outcome of a process defines the intent of the process. To me, this seems like a non sequitur, as obviously unintended outcomes can arise from processes. But is there a more specific logical fallacy that describes the argument of outcome defines intent? Thanks for all that you do. Cheers, Michael. What do you guys think?
Well, I don't know if it's a logical fallacy, but I mean, that's a tautology. That's exactly what that is. It's defining the outcome by the premise and vice versa, defining the premise by the outcome. It's a snake eating its tail.
Yeah, but I think there's something that's a little bit closer to that because he's not framing it as quite as a tautological argument.
You don't think he is? I mean, he basically said the outcome is intended. And he said, how do you know it's intended? And he said, because it's intended.
Because of the outcome.
I agree that there's a
tautological.
Yeah, but I don't think
logic
that
there.
Is
but
an informal logical fallacy, is it? Tautology.
A tautology, I think, is a formal logical fallacy.
Oh, is it? Ooh.
Ooh, formal.
A equals B because B equals A.
All he's saying. I feel like he's committing a very...
But he's saying that in order to justify a conclusion that is what? What, you know, he said, what is the outcome defines intent? What is that? It's another T word.
Mm.
It's a teleology. It's a teleological explanation. The outcome is the cause, right?
But there's no evidence for that endpoint.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There has to be independent evidence. But also causes, effects cannot cause the cause. You know what I mean? The causes cause effects. So it's kind of
like roll a dice 10 times and the 10th time it's a 5. That was the intent, right? Well, give me a break.
Well, but the funny thing is that by definition, a teleological argument is an argument for the existence of God.
Well, often that's the case. So, when you talk about argument for design.
Intent, like you think there was a mind that was present before the whole process began that said, this is my end goal.
It's like this outcome was designed.
Yeah, it's that there's a creator. Yeah.
Because of the
complexity.
It came
never,
out.
Never, ever in evolution.
But even like we see this in other more subtle arguments, like, for example, the qui bono argument of, well, who benefited from this happening? Therefore, they're behind it. They caused it. That's a common component of conspiracy theories. It's like, well,
I mean,
you know, people could benefit.
It's a good research angle, but
there's no evidence.
At best, it's a hypothesis. At best, it's a hypothesis, but they use it as a conclusion. This person benefited from this happening. Like the Twin Towers went down. Who benefited from that? Well, they obviously engineered the whole thing because they benefited from it in some way, whoever that was.
The military-industrial complex or whoever you want.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right. So you can go to war.
Well, they said that that's one of the arguments they put forward is that because we went to war as a result of 9/11, that the administration must have caused 9/11 because they wanted to go to war. Again, they're reversing cause and effect. It's like, well, you know, people could benefit from things accidentally that they did not cause, and not every outcome is intended. And you know, the assumption that it is putting the outcome at the center, saying the outcome is the cause of everything that led up to it. That's a teleological argument, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
Yes.
Yep. Say so.
All right.
Check.
All right, guys, let's move on to science or fiction.
Woohoo.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There's a sort of theme here. There's computer processing involved in all of these news items. All right. It's a loose theme, though, because it's like just one of the mechanisms of the research is computer evaluation of data. But here we go. Item number one. A new study demonstrates that a computer program, after a brief learning period, was able to accurately predict subjects' visual art preferences. Item number two. Neuroscientists have been able to reproduce a bird's song entirely from the pattern of electrical activity in their brain. And item number three, an extensive review of written languages finds that the complexity of graphic codes, letters and characters, tend to decrease over historic time. Evan, go first.
All right. Computer program, after a brief learning period, was able to accurately predict subjects' visual art preferences. All right. I'm kind of buying that one. I don't think that's so far astray that it would be impossible. The second one about reproducing the birdsong entirely from the pattern of electrical activity in their brain. How complex is a birdsong? I suppose if I knew the answer to that, that would help me determine whether or not this one's right or not. I suppose some birdsongs could be simple in the context that this could be true. Not so complex that it wouldn't be able to happen. So this one's possible, very possible. And the last one about extensive review of written languages, finding the complexity of graphic codes, letters and characters tend to decrease over historic time. Well, that's interesting. Basically finding more condensed or refined or simpler sort of ways to give the words, give the letters, the characters, and so forth. Basically simplifying it goes from complex to simple. That could be as well. Over time, you would want to get it down to where it was refined and just have to spend kind of less energy overall on it. So I have a feeling that one winds up being correct. So therefore, of the three, I have a feeling the art one, the accurately predicting the subject's visual art preferences, that has the most subjectiveness to it of the three art preferences. I mean, that's pretty subjective. So I don't know that computers are quite there yet for that and have not gotten to the level of accurately predicting it. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right. So the first one here, a new study demonstrates that a computer program, after a brief learning period, was able to accurately predict the subject's visual art preferences. Man, how could that possibly, when you say brief, what are we talking about?
I mean, I didn't tell Evan, so I'm not going to tell you. I think it's pretty commonsensical.
Okay.
Obviously wasn't months or, you know.
All right, I think it's science. I think that's absolutely doable.
You sold him, Steve.
Sold him. Thank you. All right, so anyway, neuroscientists have been able to reproduce a bird song entirely from the pattern of electrical activity in their brain. Whoa! How can this possibly be? There's a pattern of electrical activity in their brain. So they have to be able to map that notes, literally notes, and possibly duration to activity in the brain. All right, that one is a big, almost a definite no, but I'm going to read the last one here. Extensive review of written languages find that the complexity of graphic codes, letters, and characters tend to decrease over historic time. Complexity of graphic codes, like letters and characters, I would say that they decrease. I would say that they increase. This is hard because we live in such a snapshot. Like, you know, not like the alphabet has changed an iota since I was born. You know, they may have added maybe some punctuation or whatever. I would definitely say that this one is the fiction because I don't think that they become less. I think they become more complex.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, so the computer program and the brief learning period. Yeah, I mean, I could see how that would work. That's not really, doesn't sound outrageous. The second one, reproducing the song from the pattern of electrical activity. Sure. I think we're at the point where we could do that. Especially for a bird brain. Yeah. To me, that's not shocking. The third one though. Yeah. I mean, I'm going back and forth on this one. I can kind of make an argument either way. And because I'm fairly confident on the first two, I'm going to say that one is, fiction.
And Kara.
All right. I think that this is one of those ones where I'm lucky when people go before me and make good arguments. I think the one that has to be fiction for me is the language one. This idea that Jay said that I think things would get more complex over time. The bird brain one seems realistic, although amazing. And then the visual art preferences, like Instagram, like sells me crap all the time. Like they have me pegged. So clearly we have really good AI that can just like see what your preferences are based on what you click on and then be like, if you like X, you'll love Y. And I don't see why that would be an issue. So yeah, I think it's the language one that has to be the fiction to me.
Okay, so you all agree on the middle one, number two, so we'll start there. Neuroscientists have been able to reproduce a bird's song entirely from the pattern of electrical activity in their brain. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. Yeah, this is baby. Cool. And Evan, answer your question. These are complicated bird song. I think it was you who asked that.
I did. Yeah, I imagine the some are complicated, some are simpler than others.
The purpose of this is actually to develop an application for humans. This is for people. So to basically like a voice synthesizer that could be activated by people thinking. You know, you think of the words you want to say. Right. That's the goal of this research, but they were using zebra finches, actually, which is a very common research animal.
Mm-hmm. Why?
I'm not sure. They're just very, I guess they're just convenient to use in research or easy to keep.
Was they saying, yeah, we used to use zebra finches in our lab. They're just available. They have really reproducible bird song. It's easy to study too.
I would think the complexity of the song is almost irrelevant. The complexity of the brain, I think that would be the real important thing.
I think those two things go hand in hand, though. The fact that they are able to generate such complicated bird song means that that part of their brain has to be fairly complicated. Now, Jay, I think it was you who were saying, though, they have to be able to reproduce like every note and duration, whatever. But what the researchers discovered, the approach they took was not to break it down to such fundamental pieces, but to try to take it more in chunks, So, because otherwise it would have overwhelmed their computing processing power, right? So they had to figure out some way that they could get the information processing down to a manageable level. And so they were able to do that. So of course they would record the electrical activity in the brain while they're singing. And then they had the computer analyze that and develop an algorithm that could correlate the song to the electrical activity. Then they had to prove their algorithm by going the other way, by reading the electrical activity in the brain and generating the bird song from that. And they were able to do that. So that demonstrated that their algorithm worked. Yeah. So again, they're doing this as a proof of concept in order to develop this for humans. That was the goal of the research.
Cool.
All right. Let's go on to number three. An extensive review of written languages finds that the complexity of graphic codes, letters, and characters tend to decrease over historic time. Bob, Jay, and Kara think this one is a fiction. Evan thinks this is science. And you three guys all think that graphic codes get more complex over historic time?
Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. I don't like it when Evan's on his own.
Yeah. So when the authors...
That's not always... I get it. I get it wrong often.
Go either way.
So not that often.
Now, I'll tell you, before I give you the answer, that the hypothesis of the authors doing this study is that they would decrease over historic time because that's what tends to happen in languages.
Oh, that means it's the opposite.
They get more and more simple.
That makes sense to me.
Why did you pick this one?
It's because I could make an argument either way. It seemed less certain to me because look how language changes. Words are smushed together to make it easier to pronounce. Whole nother and all that crap. I would think that the actual characters would simplify as well. I can make an argument for that.
Shortcuts.
But either way, I can go either direction.
That was my thinking.
That was their hypothesis, and they tested that by looking at 47,000 characters from over 133 languages, scripts. And what they found was no change over historic time, that the complexity was remarkably stable. So this one is the fiction.
Oh, wow. The third option.
Yeah, so... Which no surprised change. Them. They said, why would, because, if you have like this really crazy complicated character, it takes more energy to create it. And it's also more, it's more work for your brain to interpret it. It's more cognitive load. And so that's why they thought, well, over time, it must be stripped down to its essence so that you could recognize it as the letter, as that character, without any extra squiggles or doodads that are unnecessary, are not conveying any extra information. They would optimize, but they were surprised to find that didn't happen, that they were relatively stable. So one of their their now follow-up hypothesis to explain why they were wrong is that, well, maybe languages optimize so quickly that we're just missing that rapid optimization phase, and then they become stable over the vast majority of their lifetime. So does that make sense? So like you said, like the alphabet that we use, the A, B, C, D, you know, the letters are pretty simple. Like, there's not a lot of extra squiggles and lines or whatever in there. They're pretty optimized. That, see, maybe that just happened so quickly that there was no further optimization to be had. And so that from that point on, they just plateau, you know. Mm. They also had an interesting question, and that was, do characters tend to be more complicated from left to right or right to left? So, like, if you look at the left side of a letter, for example, does that part of it tend to be more simple, or the right side? And does that relate to the direction in which words are read, like if we read left to right or right to left? And what they found is that there was a tendency for characters to go from more complex to less complex in the direction that of reading. Does that make sense? Or writing.
In both cases. So regardless of which direction it goes, that is the trend.
Yes, exactly. They also found that the amount of complexity of each individual character, what do you think was the most significant factor that determined that?
Determined what again?
What's
how it like how complex each character is in a language.
How often it's used?
Nope. So let me put it to you a different way.
The verbal component?
If we go language by language, how come the characters in one language are more complex than the characters in another language?
Phonemes, easier to speak.
Yeah, do they do more grammatical lifting?
The amount of phonemes in the language?
It's the number of characters in the language. Yeah. The more different characters that a language contains, the more complex they each one is.
Oh, that's weird. I would think it'd be the opposite.
Well, I mean, it could make sense. Like, you need to be able to have 72 distinguishable characters. You need to add more complexity in order to make that possible. And of course, characters are more than just letters, because some languages, they have characters that represent syllables, not just phonemes. And they might have like letters combined into characters. And so they might have like some languages have maybe 30 letters, but 300 characters. And then, of course, you have the pictorial languages like Chinese that have thousands of characters for each word, one per word. So there's like one per phoneme, one per syllable, one per word is basically how it breaks down. Yeah, but I always find it fascinating when the hypothesis is falsified against expectation. That's what they found. And it was a pretty extensive review, so it's not like the not sampling error, probably. All right. All of this means that a new study demonstrates that a computer program, after a brief learning period, was able to accurately predict subjects' visual art preferences is science. This also was somewhat of a surprising finding because the question was, is artistic taste so quirky and subjective that it's not something that a computer could strip down to an algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess you can, right? But there were two aspects of the artwork that the computer program was looking at. And one was basic features, like how broad are the brushstrokes and how many primary colors there are and things like that. And then the other was more high-level abstract aspects of it, like is this impressionism or cubism or whatever. And so using a combination of those two things, they were able to, you know, rapidly develop a sense for an individual subject's tastes in art and then use that to accurately predict how they would rank fresh art samples. Better than chance, of course, but they said it was, you know, fairly accurate. So it is interesting to think about that, like how much of our art preferences can be stripped down to things like we like broad brushstrokes or whatever. Like, what are the kinds of things that would appeal to us? Although people did tend to segregate into the big categories. Like, there were definitely people who liked representational art, others who liked impressionism, others who liked, you know, cubism as well. So I guess we're predictable in our artistic tastes. We're not as quirky and unique as we'd like to think.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Which I do think makes sense. I do. I mean, you know, when you think about yourself and the kind of things that you like, you know, like I have certain tastes, and over the, you know, you're getting to your 50s, you kind of have, if you have any kind of self-awareness, you become aware of your own tastes. Like I kind of can predict the sorts of things that I like. Like, for example, in jewelry, I like things that are very simple and elegant, and anything that's even slightly complicated to me is gaudy as hell, right? which there are people in my life who have extremely different tastes when it comes to things like that. And I've learned, you know, that about myself and others. And same thing with art and with music, whatever. You sort of develop a sense for what your tastes are in a reductionist way almost. You know what I mean? It's not just like every piece is individual. It's like you could define the characteristics of something that you like.
Yeah. Like, I like, you guys agree? Black. I wear a lot of black.
Yeah.
I don't like really bright clothes.
I think AIs in our future are going to be just so bored. Like, you humans are so predictable. They're going to, like, repeat every word we say, but a nanosecond after we say it. Or before we say it. No, a nanosecond before we say it. It's like, you guys are so boring. I'm going to go talk to the dolphins.
I mean, that is... No, seriously, that is... When we extrapolate this out, how scary is it going to get? It's already scary when you think about social media algorithms and the marketing tools. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. My Instagram has me down.
Yeah, they know things about you before you do. Like, they can figure things out about your preferences and the probability of you. Like, they know when women are pregnant, you know, before
that's,
they're
that's a whole thing do. Right there. The guy developed that algorithm, he came up with the first person to come up with that algorithm. It was a fascinating story I read. And the bottom line was that if you could hook someone, like a mother, a newly pregnant woman, if you can get them to start buying your products, for their first kid, they're going to keep buying those products for their 20th kid. Mm-hmm. Throughout the entirety of their life, they're going to be buying your products once you get them, because they rarely change. So that guy got a big raise that day, I think. He came up with that.
I mean, I feel like all the time on Instagram, I talk about this with my friends all the time, you'll be shopping for something online so whatever, the algorithms know that you want it. But then you'll get some sort of recommendation for something that you've never looked at, you've never shopped for, you've never known that you wanted, and you're like, how do they know?
They got a random element in there. Sometimes it works.
Yeah.
But how many times is it suggesting things you don't pay attention to because it didn't catch your interest and you kind of glossed over it and didn't really pay attention to it?
I think that's
an accurate record. Yeah.
No, that probably, I mean, I think you're totally right, Ev. I mean, they're looking at cookies on your computer right now.
Yeah, it's not perfect.
So, yeah, I mean, and those cookies are dropped depending on your clicking activity.
But they're not just looking at. What I'm saying is, it's not just what you're looking at, it's what other people who looked at those things also look at. So then they have more data. And then what those people tended to buy when they were also the kinds of people that tended to buy those things. And then eventually they're predicting preferences because we are not that unique.
Do you guys remember the 2013 movie Her?
About the
guy who's dating his computer assistant. Yeah,
yeah, his Siri. His
artificially intelligent virtual assistant. When they were setting it up, they were like, all right, we're going to now like individualize your AI assistant to your personality. And they asked the guy three questions that seemed totally random.
Oh, my God.
And then they have him completely dialed in from these three questions. You know? I thought that was so funny, but probably not far off from reality.
Yeah, maybe five questions maybe.
Right.
Oh, great.
Right.
Smash personality tests.
Well, the thing is, this is what it really comes down to, is that we're not used to thinking of how predictive things are, the predictive value of bits of information. But computer algorithms are all about predictive value, right?
Sure.
And so it's like the Akinator. I know I've spoken about this on the show before. Like, think of any one real or fictional in existence. And then it's like six questions, they figure out who you're thinking of, because they're asking these weird questions that you don't understand why they're asking, because you don't realize how predictive that little piece of information is about the ultimate information. And so it's the same thing. I bet you that it's going to be scary how easy it's going to be to predict human behavior from seemingly quirky bits of information.
Isn't that what mentalists do to a certain degree?
Totally. Totally. Absolutely, Evan. That you know, people are more predictive than we'd like to think, you know, in terms of the way we perceive information and think about things. Like, you know, absolutely, you're correct. So that they've just over centuries of trial and error have hacked human behavior significantly. Imagine when we put that to AIs.
Oh boy.
It's scary. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Though the world does not change with a change of paradigm, the scientist afterwards works in a different world. Thomas Kuhn.
Yeah, you know, the structure of scientific revolution. So his whole idea was that, you know, that there are paradigm shifts, you know, where the scientists are operating under one paradigm until that doesn't work anymore. And then there's a shift to another paradigm, but that you can't, you know, in its extreme, even Kuhn didn't believe this, but like the extreme Kuhnians would say, well, there's no objective difference between the two paradigms. Like one's not truer or more accurate or better than the other. They're just different explanatory systems.
That's bullshit.
And it's totally bullshit.
He disliked the term Kuhnian from my understanding.
For sure.
From what little I've read about it.
He really pushed this idea that while you're operating within a paradigm, you are subject to the same social forces as anyone else. I mean, I think if anything, what Kuhn did was humanize science. He was saying people do science, people have social forces, and they operate within a paradigm. And until it no longer fits or works, or we have better information, it becomes overthrown. And then it's actually very hard to look through the eyes of a historical paradigm when your eyes have been open to this new information.
Yeah, it works in a different world, totally.
Yeah.
But one of the main criticisms, though, is that Kuhn divided science into regular science and paradigm-shifting science, and that's a false dichotomy. There's a continuum, you know, in terms of how big an impact any particular new idea or study or information has on our models, right? Not everything is like going from classic physics to relativity.
Or plate tectonics to no plates.
Or plate tectonics. You know, that was a huge shift in our thinking. But the idea that these are not better, that they're just different, is also just nonsense.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, but Kuhn remains an important part of our, you know, philosophy of science.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And we're going to see you all in just 2 days because on Friday we're recording. It's too late if you listen to the show. So we did announce this last week, but on Friday we are recording the a full episode as part of the live stream. And we're going to try to do that more, you know, for our patrons and our members that, you know, we're going to like stream some of our recording of the show that you can listen to live and maybe even give us feedback. We're thinking about how to do more of that, but we're going to do that on Friday. And that episode will go up in a couple of weeks. But until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.